Hey, Larry.
Hi, Andy.
How's it going?
Could be worse.
Do you think your internet's going to survive tonight?
I doubt it.
So this is going to be an abbreviated show where we're putting one in the pocket, I guess, is as a way to express that. With scheduling conflicts, I'll be out of town next week. So it isn't we're not going to be covering any news items. And we're going to be recording this as if it were the future. But really, to you, it's the present, but we're in the past, and it's really confusing.
You think it's going to be abbreviated when you start getting into these topics that you've put on here. You're going to find out how abbreviated this is going to be.
Sounds like you're threatening me.
So I can just see what's coming.
So we did have, to start this off, a listener posed in a couple questions, so we will cover those. We were going to cover them. We recorded last night. We were going to cover them, but with your stellar internet, it didn't work out so well. But the email came in. It says, "How is it that some states the registry is considered punishment, and in other states it is simply a public service? I'm thinking of the ex post facto registry requirements for SOs who have completed their sentences."
There's so many questions buried in this that we could spend a program on this, Andy, because we'd have to dissect. The registry is considered unconstitutional because the first point is there's been a challenge. All registries have not been challenged. Most of them have, but they haven't been challenged recently. So, for example, in my state, the last serious challenge was more than a decade ago. So a registry that may have been deemed constitutional a decade ago when the Supreme Court of your particular state, and I don't know where this person is that wrote the question, but when the court last looked at registration, it may have not evolved. I mean, Michigan is thrown in here as an example. Well, Michigan courts looked at registration in Michigan multiple times. But it was only when they looked at it the most recent time, and they looked at the enhancements that were added in 2006 and 2011, they said, wow, you just can't keep stacking. You've got it now where people are restricted in where they can work, where they can live, and this is too much like probation. But registration in of itself is not unconstitutional, so it would be possible for a state to have a constitutional registry. There's no court going to ever rule that you can't have registration because we register too many things. And registration is not unconstitutional. We register voters, we register school children, we register guns, we register cars, we register young men for the draft. I mean, I can go on and on for the rest of the program about what all we register people for. So merely registering someone is not punitive. But when you require someone to register and you build in a lot of things like what these states have done since their courts last looked at them, then that's how you get the translation that, well, sorry, you've gone too far now. You're inflicting punishment. This is not a civil regulatory scheme. You've actually got a state or two out there that's not really inflicting a whole lot of punishment. You look at Vermont, you mail in a form. And a form that you mail into the state once every year. It's really not all that onerous to mail in a form. Now, if you happen to be one of that segment of the registrants who's listed on the internet, absent your specific address, but with your city and town, you probably would think that's a little more punitive. But simply mailing in a form with having no other restrictions imposed on you is really not punitive. And if you were to challenge Vermont's registry the way it's constructed today, you would be very unlikely to get a finding that it's punitive.
Okay, so Miriam Aukerman is the attorney in Michigan that works for the ACLU that did the Michigan challenge. And then I guess the other is the Alaska one that was like in the early 2000s. Is that the other big challenge where the Supreme Court said it's not ex post facto?
The Supreme Court ruled on two ex post facto challenges, the one out of Connecticut, one out of Alaska.
Okay.
The Alaska dealt with registration itself. Connecticut dealt with posting on the internet, and that both decisions came about in 2003, and they said that posting a person's picture and information on the internet was not punitive. A lot ha we have a different internet today than we had in 2003, and I'm not tech enough to explain the difference in technical terms. But the widespread usage of the internet, from shopping to criminal records, I mean, everybody goes online today. In 2003, we're still early, and the courts didn't have a full appreciation of what the internet could do, nor was the case properly developed. Because in the early challenges, arrogant attorneys just assumed that since it was being done on an ex post facto basis, that automatically made it impermissible. So rather than developing their cases, they just said, well, we're going to make a simple claim. It's ex post facto. You can't do an ex post facto. The Constitution doesn't say you can't do ex post facto laws. You cannot inflict punishment, but you can make a civil regulation ex post facto. If you were to change the regulatory requirements about food temperatures, you wouldn't say, well, you know, we've learned now that that food must be kept at 180 degrees, even though your oven won't do that. We'll let you keep food at an unsafe temperature at 150 degrees because your grandfather doesn't work that way. So normally there's an opportunity for compliance and an adjustment period, but a civil scheme that changes can be changed on an ex post facto basis. Where the lawmakers have gotten tripped up is nobody bothered to tell them where they were debating changes. Nobody said, Madam Chair, you can't do this. You're going to tip this regulatory scheme to where it inflicts punishment, and I'm going to be right up your ass with a pickaxe challenging you when you do this. You're going to take a registration scheme that you love and adore, and we're going to knock it down if you do this, because you're inflicting punishment with these requirements, and you can't do that. We were absent in most states when this was when they were debating all these enhancements. When I say we, the advocates for people who are on the registry.
Certainly, the collective we.
Yeah, the law enforcement was well represented, but the registrants were not there, so the arguments were not made. Nobody heard that this is punishment. Therefore, you're jeopardizing the regulatory scheme. But you can change a regulatory scheme. You just can't inflict punishment but with the changes you make.
Can you give me an example of changing the regulation behind the registry that would be okay, that's not punishment?
If the registry was as benign as Vermont's is at last time I checked, you could take a 10-year registration scheme and you could increase it to 20 years. If you're not punishing the person by them having to mail in a form once a year for 10 years, having them mail in the form for an additional 10 years would be no more punitive than it was the first 10 years.
Fair.
So you could change that and it would not be punitive. But if you said, in addition, we're going to make the change that you don't mail in a form anymore, you come in person and you get your fingerprints taken, you do this every 90 days, and then you're restricted to where you can live, restricted in where you can work, and you're restricted in where you can travel without giving us advance notice, like most of these states have done, then you're imposing a lot of restrictions that in the collective analysis would be punitive. But mailing in a form, I don't think anybody can argue is all that punitive.
Right, because you mail in your car registration form already, so that would be basically
right.
the same as that.
But so before you write in to us and say that you're supporting the registry, I am
yes.
not. I'm just giving you what will fly on a legal challenge. You can't say something is punitive simply because you're having to do it on an ex post facto basis. They could tell you to mail your, like, driver's licenses. What happens if you get to be an older person and they think they need to check your vision more often? They can change the requirement that a person over 70 or whatever year they pick must come in for a more frequent visual examination. And they do that in my state, as a matter of fact.
Right.
Because vision deteriorates rapidly. So that's a regulatory scheme that changes when you reach a certain age. But they could change it the other way. Driver's licenses can be changed because that is in fact a regulatory scheme. We're issuing the license to make sure that you have the proper skills to operate a motor vehicle, and that you can have the visual acuity to be safe on the road.
In the interest of public
safety.
And if
we learn more about what we need to do to keep people in interest, and if we learn more about what it takes to keep people safe, we can change the requirements for driving. Now, as a political matter, you're not going to go and cancel licenses for millions of people. So in the reality, you're probably not going to make significant changes to a broad number of people because you would have political fallout. Unfortunately, the registrants don't have a large political block, but drivers would have. So if
Certainly.
You went in and canceled everybody's license and said you're going to have to retest, there would be a tremendous political price to be paid.
But you have every state bolting together what they think is within what the public wants, what's in the interest of public safety, to where Alabama and those guys down there have really harsh situations where, like what you're talking about, Vermont has pretty, you know, pretty tame, let's call it, in at least by comparison, whether you like having a registry or not. Does Vermont have pictures posted?
If you're in the category that gets
okay.
listed. And
not
they
just
have
everybody.
They have a level system, and then they a few years ago, they turned it into a hybrid system. So it was risk-based, and if you're a level 3, and then they added, I believe, crimes against minors, so regardless of risk. So you have a risk-based hybrid with offense-based that puts you on the internet. But there again, you don't have the home address. So vigilantism, I've never heard any in Vermont. I'm sure it happens because there would be leakage from the registry that people would find out. But as far as just being able to single out and target people, their physical address is not on the registry. It'll just say a town last time I checked. So I don't go on registries every day to check. So it's conceivable this could have changed. So don't hold me to it. Just go do your research if you have questions. But I don't believe they've changed that. I think we would have heard about it at NARSL.
That's interesting. But so to the question specifically asked that the registry is considered punishment and some consider it just public service, I haven't heard them termed that way, where one will say it's just civil regulation, where another one is considered punishment.
Well, they're all considered civil regulatory until the court declares otherwise, because every legislative preamble says that this is not designed to punish, that this is a civil regulatory scheme. So they pronounce in the preamble, that's all boilerplate preambles that you've looked at all 50 states, they'd be very similar. So they've created what they call a civil regulatory scheme. And then they've put a lot of punishment into the regulatory scheme because there has been no pushback. So in Alabama, when the legislature's convened, or any number of states, I'll pick on Alabama, but all over the Southeast for that matter, these proposals come in to make it more harsh, more punitive, and there's nobody there. When I say nobody, there's probably the Public Defender Association, maybe from the state, but there's very few people there explaining to them why you can't do this. And everybody that they look up to is there telling them why they should do this, which would be the district attorneys, the judges sometimes, the chief prosecutors and their representatives, the victims' advocates, they're all telling the lawmakers, I have a right to know. This keeps me safer. The proponents of the registry are there in force. And they look around the room and they say, anybody opposed to this? And not a single hand goes up. What is a lawmaker to do in that environment?
Well, obviously, all of the people that are voting for him are saying they want it. So why would he oppose it?
Well, even beyond the people voting, if there were someone manifesting themselves in the Capitol during the markup process where they're working on these bills, if there was someone standing there saying, well, actually, here's the problem with this. But the advocates have been largely absent. We don't have people on the ground. I can think of just very few states where they have anybody on the ground to push back. And it's a very expensive proposition to be there on the ground. You got to take off time work. You got to be in the Capitol. You got to spend the whole day there.
And so, okay. So 2 episodes ago, we interviewed Brenda, and you were helping analyze bills that she had pulled, I'm assuming off of the website, off of her state website, where there were bill proposals in place. And you helped her craft, would the word be talking points and counterpoints to why a bill is going to have a challenge of some sort? Is that a role that you play?
We did work with her, with Marilyn. We came up with talking points, and you have to first figure out what legislation will do before you can come up with talking points. So you have to look at it, be able to figure out what would be the result of this legislation. Then you have to be sinister and say you have to figure out what, if it was used in the most unintentional way by an overzealous, unscrupulous person, what could they do with it? And then you have to figure out what your talking points are about why. And your talking points always vary depending on who you're talking to.
Fair.
If you go in and try to talk to a law and order conservative and tell them that this is going to be inconvenient for a sex offender, you don't usually get a lot of traction with that. Even with liberals, you don't get a lot of traction, but you're liable to get more of a sympathy from a liberal. So you have to tailor your pitch to whoever sits on the committee that's reviewing the legislation. So when you're pitching, for example, residency restrictions, if you're pitching a conservative that's from a rural part of your state, you would make a different argument to them than you would make to someone from the inner city. So there's a lot of skill involved in trying to figure out what to say, what your points are. There was a time when conservatives cared about the budget. We're seeing in the last few days that they really don't at the federal level. But oftentimes you can make a fiscal argument with a conservative that'll resonate. So it's like there's some complexity in figuring out who your audience is and what type of argument they might buy into. Women are more sympathetic, like women lawmakers are more sympathetic to a family type argument. They're more family oriented. I'm sorry to tell you guys out there, but women are more sympathetic to the needs of the family. So if you're pitching a female lawmaker, you can sometimes gain traction about how this will be disruptive to a family and to children. Men do care about their children, but women have a much stronger maternal instinct. So it's all unique to who you're making the argument to.
And so, but in identifying potential challenges, then you're also then tailoring the message, the talking points to go back. So you have a many-to-many relationship. You have the individual challenges themselves, and then how are you going to present that to the various people on the committee? Is that where we would go then? Is this only at like a committee level that we're talking about this?
Public involvement comes usually through committee processes. Most states, not all, but most states allow public participation in the committee process as far as making comments, be they verbal or written. And when it gets to the floor of the assembly, whether it be House or the Senate, there's no public participation. You can often sit in a gallery, but that's it. So your involvement is in the committee process and communicating with the committees that are vetting the legislation. You can't run all the legislation through the main body for vetting. You have 600 bills introduced in a 30-day session. You can imagine of the 600 how many would get through if you took all 600 to the 112 member assembly. you wouldn't be able to cover it. So that the workload is divided among committees that are assigned that have expertise in particular areas of legislating. And so you would have things that with an environment would go to that type of committee, and things to do with changing of laws generally goes to some type of judicial proceedings committee. And you make your arguments there in the committee process, both privately to people that sit on the committee if you have access, or public if they take public comment, which many legislative committees do take public comment.
Does it matter significantly in a written opposition versus a verbal opposition?
I don't think that it's easy to say whether which is better, because depending on who you send the written, most committees have analysts. So if you can get something substantially good to a committee analyst before the bill goes before the committee for consideration, it may end up in the analyst report. I mean, that's kind of the relationship I have. I concentrate a lot on getting stuff before the analyst, because the analysts decide what the lawmakers need to know. That's how they come up with their questions. Believe it or not, boys and girls, they're not experts in all the things they have to consider.
I think that's probably a misnomer right off the bat.
So that they depend on others to help understand stuff. Your interests are not great enough. You can understand all the plethora of issues that state assembly people deal with. Some of the stuff is so boring they'd rather not have to deal with it. So you're dealing with people who they rely on information to be provided by lobbyists, by analysts, by the public. And if we're silent, they don't get our side of the story. They don't know how this is impacting registrants. They don't know because they haven't been told. We had an attorney general named Meese one time. You remember Edwin Meese?
No, I do not.
Well, that goes back to the Reagan administration. And he was asked about the Iran-Contra, how the president didn't know. And he had a very complex answer. He said, because nobody told him.
You've told me that story, right?
Yeah. Well. You want to know how lawmakers don't know the ramifications of what they're doing? It's because they're not told. That's how they don't know. It's just that simple. They haven't been told.
It sounds like a committee would be likened to, you work at a doctor's office and you hire a computer consultant to work on your stuff because the doctor, even though he's likely a smart person having a PhD and all that, doesn't necessarily know about computers. So you have to delegate out. And that's what these committees would be. And that would be our opportunity to go in and to some degree educate them on the challenges with a certain bill.
Correct.
Okay.
I remember just a few years ago that our House minority leader, for 2 years, he got to be majority leader because the Republicans became the majority for 2 years. But he was proposing a bill to limit access to social media. And I contacted him. I told him, you know, we're going to oppose your bill. We're going to do everything we can to kill it because it's unconstitutional. And he says, well, I think that I can disagree with you. He said, because I think since it's only for the period of the registration, it would be constitutional because it fits within their punishment. I said, well, no, the problem is everybody registers, practically everybody registers for life in New Mexico. And he says, huh? he didn't realize that. We have a small 10-year class and we have a 20-year class of registrants where before the law changed in 2005. But since 2005, everybody that enters the system, except for a very small number of low-level offenses, are on for life every 90 days. And he didn't know that. He's in the business of making laws, but that became law before 2005. He didn't know that. He didn't know because nobody told him.
Right.
So he doesn't have a giant, even in leadership, he doesn't have a giant staff to do the research. All he knew was that some constituent came to him and said, my teenager is being perved on by someone online, and come to find out that person's on the registry. Why don't you people make a law? And he said, sounds like a good idea to me. Right. And he had the council service draft up a bill, and it was so broad. And we finally narrowed it down to where I felt that I no longer had a constitutional challenge, because we narrowed it down to practically where no one would fall within the reach of being restricted. You had to have an electronic solicitation type of offense before you'd be eligible to have that condition imposed on you. And then we carved out exceptions for you could contact with your own family or your biological children, any adopted children, any children that you had a legal custody of. You could communicate with those as an exception. And like I said, when we got done with it, you could still be on social networking to communicate with minors as long as you had a relationship to the minor. And then it was only for the period of time that you were on supervision. I mean, we had it down to where nobody would be restricted, but he could have felt very good about it, because he could say, we passed a bill that restricted sex offenders on the internet, which would have been true. It's just, it would have applied to maybe 25, 30 people.
Right. Right.
So, but the public wouldn't have known that. So he could have gone out and said, I've protected kids on the internet, and we'd have a very small class of people that would have been restricted for a period of time. But that was only because we stood up and we came and talked to the leader, and we came up with an alternative language that he was willing to go along with. And then one of his own members hijacked the bill and tried to put registrable offenses, because there's registrable offenses that we don't cover that the feds would like to have on our list to make us AWA compliant. So she offered a floor amendment on the floor to put those offenses on. So then we got the bill sent back to committee for re-review, because it was no longer the same bill, and we just killed the damn thing.
Right.
Because it was hijacked by one of his colleagues. So sometimes you just can't help people.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything else you want to go over on this subject?
So, well, I hope I answered the question in terms of the punitive, because it's punishment when a court says it is, and a court can only say it is. Opponents, the person needs to look at Smith versus Doe very carefully, and they didn't say that all registration is punishment. They said that this isn't, because there are very few requirements imposed. It doesn't impose any disability or restraint. It doesn't restrict where a person can live or work. It goes on with a lot of legal dicta saying that's how we're upholding this as being a regulatory scheme. But it didn't say go ahead and stack continuously anything you want to, and we'll always uphold it as a regulatory scheme. They said, we have looked at this scheme and we don't see that this is inflicting punishment, so therefore it's permissible. So it could be that whatever state the person's in, their registry may have evolved to the point where it's clearly punitive, and a challenge would be what's needed. So come to the table with some money, because these challenges are very expensive. they have to be funded, but bring money to the table and help us mount a challenge in your state. Contact NARSL. That's what state it is, and tell us how you propose to fund it.
Yeah, but even before that, the person could come forward and say, this is what is going on. Is there something here? And then the people could figure out, you guys could figure out, yeah, this would be legit, this wouldn't be legit. Even before the money gets into the play.
Right. With only a few exceptions, most states have evolved to the point where they're very punitive.
Okay.
It would be hard for me to look at any registration scheme around the country, because if you just look at how they've stacked in Texas, there's no way that Texas is not being punitive. And in fact, there's a lawsuit recently filed in federal court last week in Texas by an attorney in I believe in the Dallas area, that's saying that we believe that Texas registry is highly punitive. It's in federal court, and hopefully that that case will go forward. But that attorney needed funding, and for people to be in the challenge, she required money, because it's a very costly endeavor to do this litigation.
Yeah,
and,
no doubt.
And so help us raise money.
Certainly. So then another question was, the 80-plus towns throughout Minnesota that have enacted their own extrajudicial city requirements beyond that of the residency limitations in place already through the state. Could you talk about that?
Well, I don't know what she means, he or she means by extrajudicial. There are many states in this country where locally imposed restrictions are valid. They've been enacted by city councils and county commissions and boards of selectmen and boards of aldermen and all the different governance systems that we have across the country. In some states, they have been prohibited by either a judicial ruling that says you can't do it because we have examined our constitution and our state law, and we believe that you are preempted by state the state law preempts you from doing that. And in case of my state, we've done it by legislative action, that there was a statutory provision that says a city and county is not allowed to impose anything that's not in the state, any requirement that's not in the state statutory requirement. So since we don't have any residency restrictions, cities and counties are not allowed to enact any because it's beyond their scope of authority. So I don't know everything about what's going on in Minnesota, but I do know that there's challenges up in the Midwest. Of the attorneys out of Illinois have gone into Wisconsin, and I think that they're either contemplating or maybe have gone into Minnesota. But the residency restrictions that they're complaining about, until they're declared to be unconstitutional by a court, the cities and counties can do them. I guess a good comparison would be in Texas. There's home rule in Texas for cities over a certain size, and then there's cities built below that size of 5,000 population that are called general law cities. Home rule cities have had the authority to do residence restrictions all along, but general law cities did not. But they just changed the law in Texas so that general law cities under 5,000 also have that authority. So you'll see a plethora of restrictions all over Texas now by the small cities.
So like 2 years ago, there was I want to say the attorney's name is Dave, but that's something in my brain, that they were challenging that and that was going in their favor. So then they turned around and changed the law.
It did, yes.
So they ripped the rug right out from underneath them.
Yeah, that it was clear. It was what we call black letter law. Clearly, before the law was changed, home rule cities had the authority, and general law cities did not. So general law cities were doing it anyway, because as I tell everybody, a law can be passed and somebody can do something until they're told that they can't.
Yes, we talk about that often.
So the general law cities did it, and they were stopped by judicial intervention because the court said, well, no, you don't have the statutory authority to do this. Well, what's the logical thing you do? Do you just fold your tent, or do you say, well, do you go to Austin and say, we would like the authority that the larger cities have?
Right.
And where the people in Texas didn't understand, they wanted to make the debate when it was being debated about general law cities, whether or not residency restrictions are effective. But that wasn't the question before the assembly. The question before the Texas assembly is, why should we have the large cities being able to protect their citizens and the smaller towns cannot? why is it that people that live in urban settings are so much more important? That was the debate.
Right.
And they had trouble understanding that that was the debate. And they wanted to bring in all the statistics about how ineffective residence restrictions are. But that wasn't the question before the
certainly,
assembly.
Certainly. Yeah. I mean, so, if I ask you why is blue the shade blue and you say it's a bus, I didn't ask you that question.
So I mean, they did a great job on what they did in terms of they put together some stellar research about residence restrictions. And they had a binder that had all the research that showed they were effective. And of course, the binder was completely empty because there is no research. And then they had a binder full of research that shows they're not effective because everybody knows they're not effective.
Right.
But that's not the point.
That's not the question.
Since the home rule cities were going to continue to have that authority, the courts didn't say you don't have the authority. They said that without statutory authority, general law cities don't have the authority. So therefore, the simple fix was to give the general law city the same power. The only argument at that time would have been, why is it that we don't give small cities the same powers to legislate if we do larger cities? And that would be where you would need to carry your binder of research and say, this is why we don't empower the small towns to regulate all these things, because X, Y, and Z is the consequence. And that's not the strategy that they took.
Mm-hmm.
Does
the ultimate result, though, does that make it easier for a further challenge to the registry or residency restrictions overall, do you think?
Unfortunately, in Texas, if we're talking about Texas, it's not a good situation because they had a great challenge out of Louisville, which the 99%+ of the town was off limits to.
Oh, I know where you're going to go. Okay.
And the trial judge turned it down, and so did the Federal Court of Appeals, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals in New Orleans. Any challenge in Texas in a federal court is not likely to be beneficial for some time. So I think in Texas they're probably screwed for a while. But in other states, that doesn't mean that challenges can't be successful. They've been quite successful in California because the Supreme Court of California said you can't do it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but Texas has just so much landmass that you would be able to banish people from areas. There would still be plenty of land left for them to go move to.
So, but there are challenges going around the country. I think that there's a small challenge going in somewhere. Nebraska, I heard about. I know that in Connecticut, they're in the process of launching some challenges on residency restrictions. So challenges are manifesting themselves all the time as quickly as the resources can be assimilated to do the challenge. As I say over and over again, the government has the resources to fight to defend these laws, and they do so. And it's expensive, and we don't have a public service fund to tap into. We can't go to as a leader of NARSL, I can't run down to a governmental entity and say, I've got a great challenge I'd like to get some government funding to do. It has to come from the private sector. And when you go out to philanthropic organizations and say, I'd really like a large donation, what you got in mind? Well, I'm going to challenge the sex offender registry. They look at you kind of strange when you ask for a donation. When you say civil rights, they perk up. And then when they zero in on what civil rights, when you say the rights of registered citizens, they look at you kind of funny, like, what registered citizen? Oh, well, the sex offender. So the support for registry challenges is going to have to largely come from the registrant community. And unfortunately, it has not materialized
in the
quantity that's needed. I mean, we're grateful for what we have, but it's very paltry compared to what the needs are.
How much does a challenge, is there an average?
Depends on whether or not you're going to be using experts to show the punitive effects. I cite the Alabama case that attorney Mitch McGuire funded out of his family resources. I think at last count, he had over $200,000 of out-of-pocket expenses into that. That's not counting his billable hours that he would have gotten paid had he been practicing law for other paying clients, but just for the experts. I know in the Rhode Island case where NARSL has raised money, we've contributed to that litigation fund over $15,000. So generally, attorneys that are looking at calling expert witnesses always they talk six figures, like $100,000 for cost related to the lawsuit. So they're not cheap.
Right. And this one was classified as question 2.5. Does Larry offer advice to lawyers in particular states fighting a registry law? And then I will add to the end of that, if you want to get in touch with Larry, I will pass information through the Registry Matters website onto him. But do you do that, Larry?
I do indeed. I work with attorneys. I worked hand in hand in Maryland with the challenge there on the two Does versus Department of Public Safety. We're building a challenge in my state. So yes, I do work with attorneys. So there's not enough registry challenges, so I can't say that I've worked in with oodles of them.
Yeah.
But I do work with lawyers. Like we're doing an amicus brief on a case out of Arizona, which is not a direct registry challenge, but it's a statutory challenge on burden shifting. And I've worked with that attorney on the amicus brief. So yes, that is what I do.
And you would be willing to help out. Okay.
Especially if there's compensation involved.
Certainly.
That's how I pay the rent.
Oh my God. You need to pay rent and eat groceries too?
I've never been able to get a pro bono. I've got to replumb my house and I have not been able to find a pro bono plumber. When I talk to people and they say, I couldn't find an attorney that will take my case, I say, well, why don't you be more specific? You couldn't find an attorney that would take your case without being compensated. But I can't find a pro bono plumber to replumb my house. And I'm very disappointed about that.
Hmm. That's an interesting concept.
I can't find a pro bono mechanic to rebuild my car. I can't find any pro bono services. And I don't understand it, Andy. Why can't I find pro bono stuff?
I have an answer, and it's because it's a big conspiracy.
How did you know? Well, what the people are, I mean, their complaint makes sense because legal services are very expensive, and it happens in their issue that many people, I don't know if I can say majority, but many people have never had an encounter with the law in their entire life.
Right.
Because law-abiding citizens, and then they get caught in an internet sting, or they're in a situation where the niece has grown up and they touch inappropriately. They end up in the system, and they've grown up going through school and the educational system, believing that the American system is so fair, and everything is people that don't have resources is taken care of. It's shocking to them, and it's a struggle for them to grasp that we don't have what we thought we were educated on in terms of resources for people that don't have money. So when you're doing a constitutional challenge, that is not a criminal charge against you. So you're not entitled to pro bono representation to do a challenge unless you're doing it as a challenge to the statute before you're convicted. If you're going to use that as a part of your defense, but people that end up in this registration scheme, this is many times way after the fact. There are tens of thousands of people, maybe hundreds of thousands of people that their crimes predate any notion of registration. And it's hard for them to adjust to, well, if I'm going to challenge this constitutional law, I've got the unconstitutionality of this law. I've got to fund it because there's no public defender. This is not a defense. I'm not being charged with a crime. And they always figured if there was anything being done wrong to them, that they would magically have free representation if they couldn't afford it. Not so. But they didn't know that because the system is something different than what they thought it was.
Ready to be a part of Registry Matters? Get links at registrymatters.co. If you need to be all discreet about it, contact us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. Call or text a ransom message to 747-227-4477. To support Registry Matters on a monthly basis, head to patreon.com/registrymatters. Not ready to become a patron? Give a 5-star review at iTunes or Stitcher. Or tell your buddies at your treatment class about us. We want to send out our big heartfelt support for those on the registry. And don't forget to say, fuck you people. You fucking matter. You make it possible. What I wanted to try and develop to possibly remove some of the cynicism of appearance of how the system works was to dig into subjects that would help people take very easy, tiny little steps to move them forward into understanding how to be more engaged, involved in moving whatever. This isn't specifically related to just us, but to whatever would be important to you. And I poked around on some websites, and it seemed like step one was to between being informed and how you vote. Granted, many of our people can't vote. That's fine. However, many of them can. We covered that a couple weeks ago, too. But getting yourself informed and then figuring out who you're going to vote for. So then I thought we would go through and start talking about subjects of how this whole process works, moving through the people we elect, moving through how a bill gets introduced, how we might break it down, how we might look at it, and try and just take some micro steps, 10, 20, 30 minutes, and work through these subjects. So from that, let's talk about members of Congress, both state and federal level. And then also there's a whole bunch of governorships up in 2018. And so the first question, let's cover, why would it even matter which party is elected governor if then the legislative branch makes the laws?
Oh, that's a very good question. So what people fail to understand, and I, being a government junkie that I have been all my life, to me it comes natural. So I assume that people understand things better than what they often do. The executive branch runs the government, and so the executive branch, for example, the 36 states this year that are electing governors, that's 36 out of 50. So we'll have governors that'll be serving through the redistricting process. When we do the census in 2020, there'll be redistricting. So the governor that's elected in this cycle, they will be presiding over redistricting. So they will get to sign or veto the district maps. Well, our good listeners in Pennsylvania just realized that the redistricting that was done in the last go-round has finally made its way through the court system and been declared unconstitutional by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court. So that would be one thing, but there's so many other things. The executive does the day-to-day management, and they appoint the overseers of the government. So like in my state, we have secretaries. We by elect to the federal system. So you have the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State at the federal level. You have all these the cabinet level positions. Well, we have a cabinet as well. In some states, they call them commissioners of things, but they're appointed by the governor. So when we get our new governor that takes office January 1st, 2019, we'll have a brand new cabinet that'll go with that governor. So the Department of Corrections will be run by a brand new secretary. And that'll mean that the new Secretary of Corrections will appoint all the deputies, the senior management of how they interpret how they want to run the Department of Corrections. Well, then we had a meeting today and people said, well, why does it matter? I said, well, the governor appoints a lot of people for boards and commissions. And let's see, we have what's called a Sex Offender Management Board here. And the Sex Offender Management Board, by statute, who serves on it. So the Sex Offender Management Board shall be composed of the following: the Attorney General or designee. That's an elected position. So that could be a person of either party. But then we get the District Attorney appointed by the District Attorney Association. Then the Chief Public Defender, which is a commission. And then we get a District Court Judge appointed by the District Court Judges. Then we get down to all, so you heard there were four people that are outside the executive's control. Okay, then let's go through a list of who's under the governor's control. The Secretary of Corrections or designee, the Secretary of Health or designee, the Secretary of Children, Youth, and Families or designee, the Secretary of Education or designee, the Secretary of Indian Affairs or designee, one member appointed by the governor who is a board member of a New Mexico Victims Organization. Two representatives appointed by the governor who are mental health professionals licensed to practice law, practice in New Mexico. A representative appointed by the governor from Adult Probation and Parole Division of the Corrections Department. So the corrections secretary and a representative appointed by the governor from the Probation and Parole Division, which is a division of the corrections. a representative appointed by the governor from the law enforcement community who has expertise regarding sex offender, a representative appointed by the governor who's affiliated with a civil liberties organization, and a representative appointed by the governor who's affiliated with a faith-based organization. So we've got 16 appointments to the Sex Offender Management Board. The governor controls 12 of them. What difference does it make? Well, it means that 3/4 of the people who sit on that board after the new governor comes in. So if we elect one governor who's running from one party, that governor is going to be, no doubt, a very law and order, staunch conservative, lock them up and throw away the key. If we elect a governor from another party, we might get, of the candidates that are running for in the primary, we might get one who's more progressive and wants corrections reform. So it makes a big difference in terms of who's going to be on boards and commissions, who's going to be holding judgeships at the governor's appointment. The governor's oftentimes appoint a plethora of people. I think people may even remember that there are thousands of appointments that President Trump hasn't even filled because he hasn't gotten through all of them.
You know, right.
The White House has been slow to go through all the positions that are presidential appointments. But those people make key decisions that affect your life. So that's why it's important who gets to be elected to governor, because the executive is running the day-to-day operations of government. When you have a problem with your unemployment check, you can call your state representative, but that's an executive function to make sure that unemployment check goes out. And if you have a problem, the executive is who runs the day-to-day operations of government. And most people don't understand that you call your state representative. All they do is call the secretary. Being that they serve in the legislature, they usually call the secretary or the deputy secretary. They can get right through to them because, oh, well, it's senator. Oh, yes, we'll take that call.
Right.
But that's how the executive runs the government. So if you're unhappy with the way your state government's being run, then you might want to think about the executive branch and who you put in charge of it. If you're unhappy the way with the federal government's being run, if you're unhappy with the way the Bureau of Prisons is being run, the director of the Bureau of Prisons answers to the Attorney General, who's appointed by the president. So the Bureau of Prisons and how they implement policies and what they do is a direct reflection of the president and the Attorney General, because the Bureau is a part of the Department of Justice at the federal level. The BOP is the Department of Justice. And people somehow or another, they disconnect from that. So that's the importance of the 36 executives, is how the day-to-day government is going to be run in your state.
How often do U.S. House members come up for re-election?
The entire House of 435 is up for re-election every 2 years.
Do the state level, do they have standardized? Are they all the same? Are they all 2 years, 4 years at the state level?
No, it varies. The bicameral model, typically, we only have one state that doesn't have that model, the unicameral Nebraska, where they have, I believe, 49 that serve and they call them all senators. But in the bicameral model, there's the House generally serves shorter terms, but in some states it's longer than 2 years. Like I believe in Maryland, it's 4 years.
Okay.
In my state, it's 2 years.
Okay.
But they're generally shorter than the Senate term. So in the bicameral, whatever term the House serves is usually going to be a shorter term than what the senators serve. The Senate is a little bit supposed to be the deliberative body that can be a little bit disconnected, because the whimsical people can put a lot of pressure on a person who's serving having to face them every 2 years.
Right.
So you need that deliberative body that like in the U.S. Senate, it's every 6 years.
Mm-hmm.
So we elect a third of the senators every 2 years. So that's protection against having a massive turnover in the Senate, because you can only turn over a third of the Senate.
Right.
If you vote all the bums out, if you consider them bums, you've still got 2/3 of them holding over, because that was the way the founding fathers designed it. You can turn over the entire House. We could theoretically have a brand new House. It's not going to happen, but yeah, we could in 2019, but we cannot have a brand new Senate.
So if the House is always coming up for re-election every 2 years, do they then end up doing less work because they're always fundraising for re-election?
I would not want to say they do less work, but some would say that. I'd say they have to work even harder because it takes a lot of money. A House member represents close to 600,000 population. They divide the U.S. up into, when they do the census, they apportion those seats according to population. So you've got 600,000 constituents in your district. So it's expensive. And depending on the geography, if you take an urban House seat where if you take a metro area, you might have several House seats in a metro area as large as Atlanta, where you've got 4 million people in a fairly compact area. So you would have five House districts within the metro area of Atlanta. But you take somebody like Wyoming, the House district is the entire state of Wyoming.
Yeah, because there's like 25 people that live there.
So it takes a lot of money. There's 700,000 or whatever it is, but it takes a lot of effort to campaign in a state of that size of geography, to travel, to do town halls. I mean, you have towns in Wyoming, they're smaller, but you have a lot of territory to cover. And if you try to strategically put your congressional offices around the state so that you can serve not only, I mean, you could just have one office in Cheyenne, but that's not fair to the rest of the state. There's a whole lot of territory that they would never be able to go see the member of Congress at the state level. So trying to travel that big, diverse geography and meet with people, it's a lot of work being in Congress, and you need money to reach those people by direct mail, by media. Even in Wyoming, media is expensive. It's not as expensive as it is in Chicago, but it's expensive to get your message out.
Right.
So it's a very, very, you're always needing to raise money because staying in office costs money. The Koch brothers want you, the Koch brothers want you out, and they fund their people to run against you.
Yeah. They've got
a
lot of money.
Sit back. If you just sit back and say, well, I'm going to campaign on my record, and you're taking hit after hit after hit about how you've not been present because you're absent for this vote, and you voted against this particular thing that's taken out of context, and you're getting hit after hit in the mail and in the media, and you don't respond because you decided you're just going to campaign on your record, and you let the chips fall where they may. Those campaigns are very seldom successful.
Do you think that a candidate, and this goes for somebody that's being reelected, but do you think a candidate believes in their position of the constituents, or are they just there because they do what the constituents want?
I'm having trouble following that question.
Well, so if you are pro, oh God, I want to come up with, you are a candidate that is in favor of criminal justice reform, but your district isn't. Do you flip-flop your position to be where your constituents are, or do you stand firm in what you believe?
Well, it depends on your, the strength of your appeal to your, if you have, you can go against your constituents now and then, but you run a great risk depending on what the issue is, because depending on what the issue is, if you go against your constituents, there would be massive funding coming against you. If you go against your issue, if you're in a strong gun toters district, and you start talking gun control, you're going to have a massive revolt because the money of the NRA, the organizational abilities of the NRA, is going to come after you.
But that doesn't answer the question. If the person still believes it, they could have changed their internal position, but their public position is what their district wants.
That is correct, and that's the kind of the Bernie Sanders model in Vermont. He's in a state where guns are widely accepted.
Right.
And if he were voting his personal position, he would say, "I'm pro gun control, but my state isn't." And I'm representing my state.
Does he have a voting record that supports gun rights?
He absolutely does have a voting record that supports that, as far as I know. Be interesting to analyze his Senate, because he's also been a member of the House. So been mayor of Burlington, I believe. Then he was in the House, and now he's in the Senate. But I know that you can take an issue less emotional than the Second Amendment,
right,
and you can sometimes go against your constituents, and if they're generally pleased with you, unless they're one issue voters, that you can get away with that, because there just isn't the organizational capacity on some issues to strike back. But if you have a well-funded candidate who wants to hit you on that issue, and they have lots of money to go after you, they can run negative, negative, negative against you the entire cycle about a vote that you took.
Right.
Or something you said, some clip of something you said. That's why politicians are so careful. If you've been in politics as long as I have been, the capacity to speak freely has been diminished by the fact that everybody at any given time could be recording. Think back 25 years. You're old enough to think back 25 years.
Slightly.
If we were in a classroom and we wanted to record the professor, what did we have to do to record the professor?
Probably get a microcassette.
We had to lug something in that was clearly visible.
Yeah.
And we had to punch record. And we had to have it out where it would be plainly obvious that we were recording. You can do a recording now and no one knows they're being recorded.
Certainly.
So candidates now are completely vulnerable to anything they say, because if it's taken just a snippet out of context and all they hear is the voice of the person saying something without the contextual situation, you can hurt a candidate badly. So when you ask candidates in public forums, that's why I tell people, don't waste your time taking in a whole caravan of people to sit down and talk with your lawmaker, because you're not going to get a straight answer. They do not trust all these people that they don't know. But they believe their strength in numbers. So they insist on carrying 12 people into the office and they try to have a conversation, a dialogue, and they get nothing but evasive answers because the lawmaker doesn't know if he's being set up. He or she doesn't know if they're being set up.
Sure. How would you go about finding what a candidate believes or how they voted? Would you go to their website, Facebook? Are there other places that you would go to track down how that particular candidate is going to represent you?
Well, if they're not in office, that's all you could do would be go to their websites and go to their public forums. If they're currently in office, with the technology we have today, most voting records are fairly easily accessible without a great deal of work. And you can go on your governmental website, whether it be state, city, or county, and see how your people are voting.
Okay, I'm going to dig out just like the conspiratorial question here. Is that information reliable? If you go to I go to one called Open States, and that is kind of an aggregate method of pulling in information from many states, all of them, and you'll get the information. And to me, I don't question it. It doesn't even come up as an issue. But if it says John Doe voted X on this issue or for this bill, that's not garbage information, is it?
Well, if you're going directly to the source of the, if you're going to the state legislative website and looking up voting history, I don't believe there would be any distortion there.
Okay.
If you're doing that, that's where I get my information. I don't use any other source, but going to the website and seeing what the final votes are.
Okay.
And what the committee votes are, and the there's some difficulty sometimes because we have a lot of legislation tabled, and the vote is not recorded in a way that you can tell, and people don't understand tabling. But so if it's endorsed by a committee, you can see who was for and who was against. And then when it goes to the floor for a vote, you can see who's voting for or against legislation. And I provide that to people who are interested in knowing, because we always find that the conservative members are voting for things that hammer down on us, but they continue to vote for them anyway, because they say good things they'd like to hear, like they're for prayer in the schools, you know, and they say that they have to look at the bigger picture. So even though they're voting to hammer down and to impose harsher and harsher penalties, they vote for them anyway because they've said something good that they like to hear about some issue to me that's not nearly as important as being as your liberties are. But
sure,
each person has their priorities, I suppose.
Of course. Is it hard to meet with, I assume it's going to be, I mean, if the person is meeting, representing 600,000 people, it's got to be borderline impossible to have any sort of FaceTime with that person one-on-one.
It's on a congressional level. It's pretty hard. If you're talking about a member of Congress or the United States Senate, you're going to have to be a major donor.
But then down at the state level,
major, it's much easier. I've never had a problem meeting with state lawmakers. Now, I've never tried in a large state like California or New York, but I've never had a problem in the smaller states like Nebraska, New Mexico, Colorado. It's relatively easy.
And their office, I mean, the districts at your state level are... if you're in Wyoming, you're driving across the whole state, but you're probably not driving that far to get to the office that is in your area, not at the state capitol. So, you know, work with the schedule. I mean, is it possible to like get a 15-minute interview with the person? Do you just call up their office and go, hey,
sure.
Is it that simple?
It's probably a lot more simple than that. When they're not in session in most of the smaller states, you're calling. These people are usually a citizen legislator, so they have regular jobs. So you're calling them at either their home or their job address, at their job phone number. And oftentimes you'll meet them at a restaurant.
Okay.
There is no office. If they happen to be a practicing lawyer or a dentist or something, they might have an office. But if they're a school teacher, unless they meet you in the classroom, there is no office. So they, if they're a farmer, they may have an office. But yeah, it's not hard to meet with your lawmakers in the smaller states. They're surprised that more people don't reach out to them. It's been my experience. They don't know why that more people don't contact them.
And can we just go like, what would be proper etiquette in addressing Senator John or Jane Doe? Do you call them Mr. or Mrs.? Do you call them John? I'm one of your people. What do you do?
Senator.
Okay. And then is it common that they would then open it up to be first name basis?
Well, if you know them on a first name basis, but otherwise it's senator or representative. But you need to have an agenda. That's what people, they think in terms of when you want to see them, believe it or not, although they're willing to talk to you, they want to talk to you about an issue specific, about a bill specific. And if you just want to chew the fat about what's wrong with government, that I don't feel like you people are doing us right, that's not a conversation that's going to be very lucrative. But if you call them up and say, Senator Stein, I want to talk to you about this last session. You had three pieces of legislation that you voted in favor of, and I don't think you really consider that. I'd like to talk to you about this bill number and this bill number. That's where you go with it.
Okay.
Or if they serve on a committee where the committee was looking at legislation that's important to you, they may not be your senator or your representative, but you can say, I want to talk to you because you serve on the Judiciary Committee and you were assigned some bills that's important to my constituency or to me as an individual. And I'd like to talk to you about there's unintended consequences that you need to be familiar with, because thankfully the bill didn't get through this year, but I want to tell you it'll be back next year. And I'd like to tell you what you didn't know when you looked at it this year. But most people just want to chew the fat. When they call somebody, they have no agenda and they're not your best friend. They don't want to talk to you about general politics. They want to talk to you about specific issues and specific legislation. So have an agenda when you call them.
And that goes to what we talked about much earlier of knowing how they voted, where their position is, or then also being educated about the laws and how you would dissect them and have your talking points to challenge a particular piece of the bill.
That is correct.
So we're kind of almost taking a full circle around. So how do you know if a particular representative is responsible for a bill you're interested in? I'm stepping outside of my understanding a little bit in how I'm asking these. So I'm hoping that you'll kind of guide me back on track a little bit.
Well, you identify their committee assignments.
Back to the website for the state?
Identify the bills back easier now than ever. That's the funny thing about it. When I got started in this, we had to go to the Capitol and we had to get paper copies of the committee assignments, of the names who were on committees. And then when we evolved to faxes, we would fax those other interested people that had faxes to tell them. But now you just go on the website and you see what committees they're assigned to. And then you look at legislation that you're interested in and you see what committee it was assigned to. It may have been a number of committees, but you see what committee or committees it was assigned to.
But the farm committee is not going to be responsible for our issues.
You're probably not going to need to spend a lot of time with members of the agriculture committee.
You're not going to technology, but you're going to be in law enforcement, judicial, criminal justice. You're going to be in those departments.
You are. And that's not to say that some people might serve on both. You may have somebody who's from a rural area who's a very prominent attorney. He serves on the Judiciary Committee and he might serve on the agriculture committee as well.
Right. Okay.
He or she. So the committees are where the sausage is made. And people need to understand that if you call your lawmaker about something before it gets to the floor and they're not on that committee, they look at you like you have beamed in from outer space because they don't have any say-so about it at that point. because it hasn't gotten to the floor. So you call them and they say, where's that bill at? Yeah, I'm calling about House Bill 42. And they say, the first question out of the staffer is going to say, they're probably never going to ask you the question. They're going to look at the computer and see where it's at. And they're going to say, well, that's actually in the House Consumer Public Affairs right now. And call us back when it gets out of committee and tell us your position at that point, because that's when they're going to get a vote. When it's in committee, unless they're on the committee, they don't have a vote.
And how many people are on a committee, roughly?
It can range from, runs the gamut from small committees, as few as 5 to 15, 18 members of the committee. Depends on size of the assembly. You have very large assembly up in New Hampshire where they have over 400 members. So the committees will be larger. You have smaller legislators. So you can only divide by the number of members you have.
Okay. Let's drill back to IML, that there was this big hoopla that it didn't go through all of the right procedures. I don't have the terminology very, very hammered down, but that went to a committee. The committee unanimously voted for it. So then the full chamber didn't see any reason to oppose it. Nobody opposed it. So off it goes.
That's not exactly what the hoopla was about. The hoopla was about that no one understands what happens when a bill passes and then it gets amended. So you had the bill started out with Representative Smith in the House of Representatives. And it passed the House of Representatives. And I believe it was unanimous. And then it sat in the Senate, and eventually toward the end of the end of the Senate session, it passed the Senate with an amendment, which meant that it was no longer the same bill that passed the House.
Right.
So at that point, it was no longer the same legislation. So it had to be sent back to the House to see if they would accept it as amended. And all the people that professed that they knew what they were talking about didn't know what they were talking about, because the first step in legislative process, when something passes, it originates in one chamber and then it gets amended in the other chamber. The first step is to see if the originating chamber will accept the bill as amended. And that's called concurrence.
Okay.
So it went back to the House, and the only question was, will you accept the amendment? Representative Smith had been trying for years to get that bill through, and he never could get it through the liberal do-good Senate because it was controlled by Democrats. But the Democrats lost control of the Senate in 14, which meant that they lost the committee chairmanship. So Pat Leahy, judiciary, and they lost the majority. So they were able to get it through the committee process, through the Senate vote, and they were able to amend it in the final stage of the process to put on the passport marker. Well, Smith was not going to, after he'd fought for years to get his bill through, he was not going to say, wow, well, they've made it too tough now. I'm going to say thumbs down to the Senate amendment. He was so glad to get it through the Senate that he said, anything you say, bro, I'm happy with.
Okay.
So he gave his members thumbs up. So when it was called up for a vote on whether the House would concur, when the sponsor says thumbs up, the members say, sure.
Okay.
Because they didn't do the work to get it to that point. And if the sponsor was happy and he was giving a thumbs up, they're not going to stand in the way, because they don't want that. They're not going to second guess, because A, they didn't know crap about it. They just knew that it was something good. And if the sponsor was happy, they were happy. So the House voted to concur with the bill as amended. That is proper process. There was absolutely nothing wrong with that process. It is how it's designed to work, and it worked exactly the way it was intended to work.
So in summary, so 435 people roughly unanimously voted for the New Jersey representative's bill. It goes over to the Senate. The Senate did the passport stamp. Is that what you said?
They did the amendment to add on to make the bill.
So then it goes back to the House and they said, run it. And it goes through.
They said, they had the option of not concurring.
I'm with you.
They could have said, no, we will not.
They could have said, fuck you, people.
If Smith had said, no, I don't like it anymore, then being that he was in the majority party, he was in the Republican Party, the leadership would have given it a thumbs down. And that's literally what they do. They signal their members up, thumbs up, thumbs down. And they, if they had refused to concur, then there would have been another step in the process. They would have sent it back to the Senate
right.
and said, will you guys recede on your amendment?
Okay.
We appreciate you passing it, but we would like the bill the way it was before you put the amendment on with a passport. And the Senate could say, oh, okay, we didn't realize you would have an objection. We'll recede. Or they could say, no, sir, we will not recede.
Right.
And if they had chosen, if it had gone to that point, then the conference committee that some people kept saying that would go to, that would have been where you would try to have come up with a way to hammer out the difference. Because at that point, you would have a bill that was different. You would have a Senate bill that was different from a House. The Senate's version of the bill would be different than the House bill. And you'd need to confer to see if you could come up with something where a conference committee would could report out that everybody could agree to. Those steps were not needed because the House immediately concurred. The people who said there was something wrong with that, they don't understand legislative process. That is exactly the way the process works. So it's just the way it is.
Okay. We went down a little rabbit hole there. In regards to being a member in a member of Congress, do they care about you more or less if you are in their district, if you're outside of their district? Because if the person that you're trying to reach is on a committee and they're in a different location than you, do they say FYP or do they take your call and treat you with respect and honor?
That's a great question. They care about you regardless if you can help or hurt them. So if you represent, you don't have to live in their district. If Wayne LaPierre calls, he doesn't live in, there's a whole lot of districts he doesn't live in, but he represents people that do.
Okay.
So for those who don't know, Wayne LaPierre is the president, the head of the National Rifle Association.
Oh, okay.
So they care about whether you can help or hurt them. They see you as when you call them, constituents theoretically can vote for them. So they look at a constituent with more priority than they do a non-constituent. But you can be a non-constituent and you can still help or hurt them. If you're from an organization that carries a little bit of clout, either to endorse or to oppose them. So yes, you do carry clout as a non-constituent, but you carry more clout generally as a constituent because they're looking, their analysis, can this person help me or can they hurt me?
And in the case of the NRA person, that identifies a voting block.
Right. And NARSL doesn't have a big voting block. When we call and say we're with NARSL, they say who?
Yeah, no doubt. So how would you recommend in communicating with your representative, what would be the most effective? So you would have mail, you would have smoke signals, you would have text message, you would have email. How would you recommend getting in touch with them to be the most effective?
Well, are we talking about federal or state level?
Yes. Which way would you recommend for each person? I mean, I'm going to assume if they're in DC and you're in California, that challenges things to actually showing up on their doorstep.
Well, at the federal level, you're going to have very little opportunity to actually talk to whether it be a representative or a senator, unless you're a major, if you're an elected official, or if you represent a large constituency voting block, or you're a major donor. But it's not physically feasible to talk to the thousands of people they represent. So they do tally mails, they tally emails, they tally snail mail, they tally phone calls. So all those are effective in terms of a major issue. But assuming it's something that doesn't have a whole lot of traffic on it, which our issue doesn't have a whole lot of traffic. So if you were trying your best approach is probably at the federal level is to approach a staff person.
Okay.
To say, I want to talk to a staffer about a particular issue that they can spend time going into detail with you. And then they'll pass it on to the representative who will put it in the file, and that'll be the last it's ever heard of. But to be effective at the federal level, it requires a large number of to really have a dramatic impact on their thinking. At the state level, not necessarily so. One person can have a dramatic impact at the state level. That's how you see all these laws named after people.
Okay.
When we have Jessicas and Briannas and all these people involved, that's not a result of some massive number of people. That's one mother of a victim of a crime who decides, I'm not going to take it anymore. How did Mothers Against Drunk Driving start?
Probably from the mother of the victim of a drunk driver.
Yep. So at a state level, you can have an enormous impact in small numbers. particularly if you're vocal, but communicating with your state lawmakers, your emails, they get such a volume of emails that that's probably efficiently, it's efficient, but it's not effective.
Okay.
Because they, unless they're personally written. See, there's all these general rules. If you go on somebody's website and you follow a link and you send a form email, I can personally vouch that those don't get any consideration, very little consideration. If you actually compose an email that's from your heart, those mean a lot to us. Well, when we look at an email that someone actually sat down and wrote, you of them, it's such an anomaly. It's like a fact. We still receive faxes. I think I get one maybe every 3 or 4 months. But when I hear the fax printing, I go, it's such an anomaly. I go look at it to see who the hell would send us one. And usually it's a junk fax.
Interesting.
But your voluminous emails are not all that effective, because all they get is you didn't put any effort into it.
Right.
You hit send. That's all you did. It does signify that there's a lot of interest in the issue. When the gun lobby gets cranked up, they can send emails faster than you can hit delete.
Yeah.
You cannot delete them as fast as they come. So, and there are a few other lobbies that are like that, that they can do the same thing. The pot lobby can do the same thing about legalizing or decriminalizing pot. They can inundate your email box.
Certainly.
But it signifies there's a lot of attention to the issue. But if your issue, like what we're dealing with, there are not going to be thousands of emails about making life better for sex offenders. So you're going to need to actually write your email. You got to have to get a little bit of help if you can't write and actually compose an email from your heart and explain, I would like to be a part of my kid's school. I can't go on school grounds because of this law that you've made. My son gets ridiculed and he can't do a sleepover because of this law that you've made. He's been stigmatized because of this law that you made. If you don't take time to do that, you're not going to ever reach these lawmakers, because there's not going to be thousands. We're not going to have to delete emails from people that are writing in huge volume about this. So it's going to have to be a well-written message that you send, whether it be by email or regular. They call it snail mail, don't they?
They do. Snail mail. They do call it snail mail. It's slow.
So, well, what's going to be faster than email? What's the next generation after email, which is almost instant? What's going to get faster?
Email is so fast. It's hard to imagine what could be faster. When you click send, the other side has it. And just a little side point about that. If someone says, well, it must be like stuck in the tubes or something, that's garbage. That's not happening. Email is instantaneous these days. There's no delay.
Well, why is it that I've got a young employee? He says that email's outdated. He said that he didn't see much difference in email than snail mail. He said you people ought to be using your instant messengers and other more modern communication. He said that email's antiquated.
For certain kinds of communication, I absolutely agree with him. But yeah, that's a generational thing. It's a totally generational thing. I don't understand Snapchat. He is probably all over Snapchat. I do not understand it.
Well, is it faster than email?
No. Sending an email message, you would have it, let's say it's 5 seconds, and you would have the instant message in 1 or 2 or 3 seconds. So yes, faster. It's more convenient. You're almost like having a one-on-one direct conversation with someone. Snapchat is about taking pictures that evaporate in a short period of time. I can really only think of one use for that, and I don't want to go into it.
So, well, I hope this has been informative for people, because we could spend a lot more time on governmental. I mean, we just touched the surface here.
We will circle back around. We will keep going over this. I think this is helpful for me too, because I'm trying to figure out how to do this for myself. And I'm much more of an introvert. I'm not really someone that goes out and like shakes hands with new people and says hi. So I'm asking you these questions kind of on behalf of those out there that are not even sure how to begin. This seemed like...
I would love to have questions from these people. Like I said, we touched the surface here.
Yep.
And I would love to have questions about, can we drill down deeper into anything that confused them? Because this is my lifeblood. I love it.
I know you do. That's why you're here. That's why I pay you the big bucks.
So I can't imagine why everybody, when I was 10 years old watching the presidential election returns in 1968, I could not imagine that every other 10-year-old wasn't doing that.
Larry, you are a freak of nature.
And when I was 14, staying up watching the 72 convention, and they went late at night to nominate the presidential candidate, and everybody was saying, turn off the TV. I could not imagine that you would not want to know who was going to be nominated to run for president. That was the furthest thing from my mind as a 14-year-old, that you would not want to know that.
You are.
And they said, well, you'll find out tomorrow. But I said, well, why not find out now?
Yeah, you're a freak. You are not normal for knowing these things the way that you do.
Well, how would you know if you don't study this stuff?
That is exactly the question. How would you know unless you study it? And that's why I study computers. How would you know?
Well, I don't know. That's why I call you.
Exactly. And I don't know about this stuff. That's why I call you. So there's a quote there. Can you read the quote for us, please?
Well, if you say so. There go the people. I must follow them, for I am their leader.
I think that makes perfect. Yeah, I can't. Alexandre Ledoux Rollin. I thought that made perfect sense because our politicians, our representatives are supposed to lead us by following what we want. And I think it's kind of obvious that that's not how it goes.
So, but yeah, let's continue on this. We could make a little section each show to talk about the process. If the questions are there, I'd be delighted to try to help people. But the conspiracy theories, I'm not delighted to hear those.
I'm not interested.
I don't believe in conspiracies.
Me neither. So much for this being abbreviated. We're at 120.
I told you, people.
Sorry. Larry, I appreciate it as always, and I hope you have a great night.
Good night, Andy.
Night. Bye.